so much for staying tuned. Next week, just before 11 o'clock, we'll take a brief pause in the programme to join the Remembrance Day ceremony at the Cenotaph. And before that, I'll be commemorating one of our finest conductors of the recent past, Sir Adrian Bolt, who died 30 years ago this year. And the repertoire he'll be conducting, bread and butter for him and musical nourishment for us, Elgar and Vaughan Williams. As to my string quintet, that's by Brahms. So please do join me same time next Sunday, 9 o'clock. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this week by Neil Miners.
An Italian operatic take on Tudor England. Monday Night Opera on 3 brings you what Donizetti called his opera of the emotions. A tale of love and deceit, royalty and romance. The story of a queen and the ill-fated object of her desires. Put the history books away and see Elizabethan England through Donizetti's eyes. Opera on 3, Roberto Devereux. Tomorrow night from 7:15 on BBC Radio 3.
And you're listening to BBC Radio 3. Now, it's midday and time for Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest today is the writer Roddy Doyle.
It was a band called The Commitments that first brought Roddy Doyle fame 25 years ago. Not a real group of musicians, but a comic novel about a group of Dublin teenagers who get together and form a soul band. It became a successful film with that memorable song, Mustang Sally, Ride Sally Ride, one of the hits of 1991. So, huge success, and Roddy Doyle gave up his job as a teacher and has gone on to write 9 more novels set in Dublin, where he grew up and still lives. One of them, Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha, won the Booker Prize, a memorable tour de force told entirely in the voice of a 10-year-old Dublin boy. Roddy Doyle's also written for children, for the theatre and the cinema, and now, after 25 years, he's back where he started. He's turned The Commitments into a musical, which has just opened in the West End. I suppose, Roddy, the obvious question is, why has it taken so long?
Stupidity, I suspect. No, at The Commitments, when the film came out, it was a bit of a monster. I was very happy to have been involved, and I co-wrote the screenplay, and I actually self-published the novel. So to go from that to seeing this film become the biggest box office success in Ireland at the time, which was home, in the space of about 4 years or less, was just slightly overwhelming, I think, if something can be slightly overwhelming. And I was busy doing other work, and I didn't want to be defined by The Commitments, much and all as I liked it. I didn't want to be the man who wrote The Commitments.
And maybe at that time a musical was not the form for a streetwise Dublin boy.
I was probably too young. Yeah, that's what I actually have never thought about that before, but actually you're right. I came slowly to the idea that a musical was worth even attending when my children began to grow up, and I'd come over here, for example, to London for a weekend, and we'd go to a show, and I began to enjoy them and to see them as quite exciting and great fun.
Did you find, and do you still find, that there's a kind of hurdle to cross between people who mix speech and then break into song?
It was one of the challenges, I suppose, of trying to make sure that the script wasn't just an excuse to string a whole load of songs together, that the songs would actually serve a narrative purpose. And in a way, the beat of the songs and sometimes the subject matter of the songs would propel the story as much as the lines coming from characters between the songs, and that the characters would stay the characters they are while singing, as opposed to being a kid from Dublin and then suddenly being a very proficient musician and then reverting to being a kid from Dublin, that it would remain consistent.
Clearly opera is going to be next for you.
Yeah.
I'll be in touch.
Yeah.
When you were talking about that Dublin kid, did he Did you, in fact, play in a group when you were young?
No, I didn't. And that's why the central character, Jimmy Rabbit, is the manager of the band, as opposed to... I never managed a band either, I'd better say. But he's a fan, and he's always an outsider. So he's either at the side of the stage or not even on the stage while the band play. If you can make wise decisions and you only realise they're wise a quarter of a century later, I think the decision to tell it from the point of view of Jimmy, this guy who loves music, absolutely loves music, dreams music, and, you know, probably leans across to the record player when he wakes up before he gets out of bed. He'd be like me in that regard. But no knowledge, you know, no education, no, didn't do music in school, know nothing about the difference, really. At this point, I suppose I do the difference between a minor key and a major, but Jimmy wouldn't have.
Clearly, your own ears have widened since those days.
Well, I needed them for the glasses.
You know? So there's obviously, you obviously have a much wider interest in music now. Anyway.
I do, in part because I gave up teaching. I read somewhere that, you know, The Commitments was a hit film, therefore he gave up teaching, but that wasn't the case at all. I remained a teacher for another 2 years, I think, after the film was released. And when I started writing full time, I found the day very long. I thought, well, I could play music while I hadn't. Funnily enough, when I was writing The Commitments, I only listened to music when I needed to. And I, with the other books I'd written since then, I'd never listened to music. It didn't occur to me that you could do that while working. And it struck me that, well, one way of filling the day would be to have music in the office. Perhaps it would seem less, I don't know, not empty as such, but long. I tried, say, putting on, I don't know, Sticky Fingers by the Rolling Stones, but it's rock music and it's, you know, it was too intrusive in a way, too welcome. So I then started listening to classical music, and actually, funnily enough, it seemed too familiar, even though I really had never sat down to listen. I was blissfully ignorant. I'd never been to a concert, for example. I knew the composers and could have recognised the music, but actually I found it way too familiar because it was almost like the music of advertising, the music of film soundtracks. I didn't find it in any way satisfying. And then I can't remember who nudged me towards Pergolesi and said, Stabat Mater. I bought a CD and brought it home, and I'd never heard it before. And it was like hearing Bob Dylan in a way for the first time ever, as I recall, or Bruce Springsteen, you know, somebody who remains with you for the rest of your life. Been intrigued and remain intrigued at how, as a somebody with no religion whatsoever, that so much of the music I love is inspired or wouldn't have existed without religion. And in many ways, you know, I was reared a Catholic, so that I suppose if when I decided that religion wasn't for me, I suppose my I was turning my back on that particular form of religion. But musically, ever since, I seem to have been turning around and accepting it again. So it's maybe it's God's answer to my rejection.
Que Moerabat from Pergolesi's Stabat Mater, sung there by Cecilia Bartoli with the Montreal Sinfonietta, conducted by Charles Dutoit. Do you think, possibly, Roddy Doyle, that people are always saying, oh, we must get young people into classical music, we must, you know, and of course things like the proms succeed wonderfully well, but maybe it's quite natural that we come to classical music later in life, that pop music is, and rock and roll, the music of revolt, the music of youth. I mean, do you think that's right?
I think it's an interesting theory, and there might be truth to it, yeah. I remember when I started going to concerts in the National Concert Hall in Dublin, even in my 30s, I felt irritated by the notion that there was a protocol to clapping, and I can understand why. But it just seemed so unnatural not to applaud when somebody did something absolutely glorious, not in mid-song, so to speak, or in mid-moment, but when it was ended. And the whole, you know, you can't really let go until somebody comes out and gives a bouquet to the conductor. That formality really gets on my wick, I've got to say, but less so.
Yeah.
Now, I suppose I just gave up and I surrendered sometime in my mid-40s. So. But I think there might be a point in what you say. I'm sure somebody else could come in and blow our theory away. But
did your family sing or play?
My father played the banjo. And my parents are in their... my father's nearly 90 and my mother's 88. And they're of that generation that they all sang. They, you know, at every party they'd sing. My father would sing The Road to Mandalay. With a certain irony in it, given that he was an Irish Republican. So it seemed like a strange choice, but it went down well. It brought the house down, so to speak. And my mother has a whole string of songs, both Irish ballads and music hall songs that she was taught to sing when she was a child, with funny lyrics and things
but,
like that.
But part of the kind of great glory of social life in Ireland is going to a pub and listening to people picking up a few instruments and starting playing.
If the people can play the instruments, yes.
Well, there are quite
one
a few. I mean,
glories.
I've been... Maybe there I've are pubs, some
yeah,
good
yeah.
Parts.
There are pubs where I'd point you at or bring you to so that we could enjoy the music. And there are others where the music is just, you know, getting in the way of the conversation. So when it's good,
drink,
it's great. Yeah, when it's good, it's really, really great.
You've chosen a piece of music that recalls your childhood, but curiously enough, it's not Irish, but American.
Oh, yeah, as are an awful lot of my favourite tunes. Mm. And this is a tune, really. It's a song by Paul Robeson, and it reminds me of my childhood because Paul Robeson was played a lot on the record player at home. And I love this song in particular. And it reminds me of my uncle, the man, Joe Bulger, my mother's brother. He, very sadly, he worked in America in the Irish Embassy, actually, in Washington, but he had to retire very young. He was younger than me when he died, because he had severe arthritis at a time when there was very little you could do about it. But he ended up living with us at home in Dublin and brought this incredible record collection home with him. And I think he must have had some sort of subscription to the Smithsonian. There were, you know, these glorious collections by Woody Guthrie and Lead Belly, these old blues players with Paul Robeson's records. They weren't Smithsonian records, but I think they came into the house with him. It's some amazingly daft Irish stuff, Irish-American stuff as well, Irish dancing on record, which is a glory, a mad glory in itself. But this is the song, if I was to choose the song that sends you spinning back to your childhood, yeah, it's not an Irish Camellia or an Irish pop song or anything like that. It's Paul Robeson, funnily enough.
A great voice.
An African-American communist, yeah.
Going your way, I'll keep going my way. River, stay away from my door. I just got a cabin. You don't need my cabin.
just a lonely little river, but I have heard somebody say that someday you may sweep my home away. So roll along, you lonely river, and find your way out to the sea. I don't bother you. Don't you bother me. You keep going your way, I'll keep going my way. River, stay away from my door. I just got a cabin, you don't need my cabin. River, stay away from my door. Don't come up any higher, I'm so all alone. Leave my bed and my fire, that's all I own. I ain't breaking your heart, don't start breaking my heart.
I don't think I've ever heard a song about a river that I haven't liked. I think that's literally true.
Yeah, and not just songs, orchestral music. You know, there's wonderful pieces about river. Do you think because it's kind of metaphor for life?
Possibly.
You know, that thing of flowing through different places, different landscapes.
Yeah, but even a good river makes a good city. The Thames.
Yeah, Dublin.
Glorious, yeah. Well, the Liffey is a crummy little thing, really, but it's I suppose it's been written up quite well. Whereas the Seine and the Thames, the Mississippi, I don't think I've ever heard a song about a river that left me cold. Seems like a guarantee to some sort of classic status.
River, Stay Away from My Door, sung by Paul Robeson, written by Harry M. Woods and Mort Dixon. One of the things that I find really extraordinary about your writing is that it taps into a kind of tonality of a place and of a society. And because you're true to that, there are rather more expletives than Radio 3 would commonly hear in a sentence.
Yes. And you're hoping it stays that way.
So, but it'd be awfully nice to hear you read from something. And so we should have asked you to do this job for us, because I'm sure you've been asked before. But we found a passage in Paddy Clark, ha ha ha, which we thought you might read.
Well, I always find it much more fun to get somebody else to find it, because I know that they're going to spend hours and hours looking for
But as I say, I think the important thing about those expletives, and you really do realise this, is that this is the way people
speak.
It's the rhythm
of the language. People, I remember my father, even when I was a child, I suppose when he deemed I was old enough to hear this, talking about a man that he knew when he was a child who couldn't go two syllables without breaking the word up and sticking an expletive in and then joining them together to make a much longer word. But it was part of the rhythm. I don't want to suggest for a second that every Irish person or everybody in Dublin uses expletives like salt on chips. That's not the case, but it's in the air. It's in the air. Like it or don't like it, it's there.
Well, read us a little bit and perhaps just tell us how it fits into the book.
Well, Paddy Clark is narrated by a 10-year-old boy. He's recalling a time, I think 1966, the 50th anniversary of the 1916 Rising, which is one of the big dates. Paddy is, I suppose, at this point, testing how far the imagination will take him, basically how far a lie will get you. And he's talking to a teacher. She hit the blackboard. Sigi Sheas, sit down. She looked annoyed and disappointed. Kevin put his hand up. Miss? Sha? Yes. Paddy Clark said his granddad's Thomas Clark on the tea towel, miss. Did he now? Yes, miss. Patrick Clark? Yes, miss. Stand up till we see you. It took ages for me to get out of my desk. Your grandfather is Thomas Clark. I smiled. Is he? Yes, miss. This man here. She pointed at Thomas Clark in one of the corners of the tea towel. He looked like a granda. Yes, miss. Where does he live, tell us? Clontarf, miss. Where? Clontarf, miss. Come up here to me, Patrick Clark. The only noise was me on the floorboards. She pointed to a bit of writing under Thomas Clark's head. Read that for us, Patrick Clark. Executed by the British on 3 May 1916. What does executed mean, Dermot Grimes, who's picking his nose and doesn't think I can see him? Killed, miss. That's right. And this is your grandfather who lives in Clontarf, is it, Patrick Clark? Yes, miss. I pretended to look at the picture again. I'll ask you again, Patrick Clark. Is this man your grandfather? No, miss. She gave me three on each hand.
I can see that you relished the language that you were a part of. And it stuck in your mind. And you were able to bring it into a very creative endeavour.
I don't know what it is. Why do I, you know, I don't think I love language or any more nor less than anybody else. But when it clicked, finally, I was writing for a good while before I had anything to write about. But I think particularly when I was writing The Commitments, quite early on in the writing of that, I began to make rules about how to present dialogue. And I began to think, this is the way to go. This is what the characters are. This isn't about hair colour or eyes. This is about the way people speak. And then as I went deeper into the writing experience, I realised, you know, virtually everything, potentially everything I hear or have heard is material. If I said, for example, at home, or perhaps, where's your mother? One of the kids might have said, she's after going to the shops. And that sounds as if it's a line from The Quiet Man, but it is spoken English in Ireland. And it's actually a direct translation of an Irish phrase. She's gone translates as Toshi Tereish, which means she is after going.
Oh.
So when the, if you like, the Irish decided to give up on the Irish language and to move across to English, they brought the grammar, or a lot of the grammar, with them. That's another reason why I think English as spoken in Ireland, is it, and probably in a lot of other corners of the globe, has extra elbows, perhaps.
Yeah. Talking about the sounds that human beings make, this next piece of music uses the human voice in a rather extraordinary way, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It's a passage of Different Trends by Steve Reich. I love the work of Steve Reich and Philip Glass and the men who are often called, the men and women who are often called the minimalists. I heard recently Philip Glass cheerfully objecting to that description of his work because they've all gone beyond that now. But it's where,
in some ways, I think Philip Glass is maximalist.
Yes. There is that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He'd probably object to that as well.
He certainly would.
But what I love about this is that it's a piece of abstract music, but he uses voice in a loop, as Gavin Bryars did it gloriously as well in Jesus Blood Never Failed Me.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. His own story, when he was very young, his parents' marriage broke up. There was one parent living on each coast of the United States, and he'd go twice a year from east to west or west to east. And the train, of course, is part of the rhythm of that, because it's 1935, I think, when this happened. He, you know, as an adult, then he realised that the small Jewish boy that he is, he's going across America in a train at the same time that small Jewish children were going across Europe in trains. So he blends his own story and his nanny, I'm not sure if nanny is the word for an American woman looking after children. His voice is nanny's recollection, a loop, a sentence or two, or a broken sentence, a railway worker, a railway porter, and then somebody else recalling the European experience. And it's an extraordinary powerful piece of music because you've got the noise of the train, you've got the human voices, and it's deeply, deeply moving.
The war is over. The war is over. Over. The Los Angeles.
Part of After the War from Steve Reich's Different Trains, performed by the Kronos Quartet. You mentioned earlier, Roddy Doyle, about when you, for example, started listening to classical music and discovered the Pergolesi in the office. But I wonder whether you can listen to music as you write, because certain music demands an attention that you might need for the writing.
That's true. And in an ideal situation, I don't realise that the music is over. You know, I've become engrossed in the writing. And then when I look up or whatever, the room is empty and silent and it doesn't necessarily mean that the writing is good. You know, that's a different day's work quite often when I go back over it and begin to edit and see what I have. And there's certain music that just drives me along in a way. It either fills the room and or it somehow drives me along. The rhythm becomes part of my working day almost. One that springs to mind is Philip Glass's Music with Changing Parts, which if I ever meet him, I'll thank him for it, leaving aside the fact that it's really wonderful. But because I think in part at least it helped me finish one of my books, A Star Called Henry. That coming towards the end of that book, and like a lot of coming towards the end of anything, the temptation to get up and walk out is very, very strong. Mm. It was the rhythm, more so than anything else, that put it on for the last couple of hours of the working day, and it dragged me across the finish line. I'm fairly convinced of that I owe him some sort of a debt.
It's interesting because I think, you see, as a musician, I can't stop myself analysing what I'm hearing. Mm. So I start paying too much attention to it. So I find it almost impossible to work with music.
Well, I don't, but I suppose I've heard of people who don't read when they're writing. Now, that could never work with me because I'm virtually writing all the time. I'm always working on a novel, really. But I can understand why people don't want the work of somebody else intruding, perhaps, polluting the work that they're doing. Or I don't find with music, again, because I'm just a fan.
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder, how did they do that? But that's just, in a way, natural curiosity. But I would never have to think, if I'm listening to a piece of music, how can I achieve that? Never, ever. So it doesn't get in the way.
Well,
so
you're a writer, not a musician.
You have my sympathy. I feel so sorry for you here.
Yes, especially if I had to miss out on performances of this piece, which I think is one of the most sublime creations ever.
This is Mozart's Requiem.
Yeah,
and I people say, why this piece? And I really don't know the answer to that, except, you know, you expressed it so well there yourself, that it's just, I remember when the arrival of the new millennium and we were wondering whether our computers would explode. Somebody made a few quid in the run-up to that. And then there were the lists of the achievements of the previous millennium. And, you know, some of them, I remember thinking, some of the novels were included. You know, were they really the best thing that ever happened in the last 1,000 years culturally? But Mozart's Requiem was high up on the lists, I think, of most that I read. And I never found myself disputing that. It is such a colossal, colossal achievement. And I don't know much about him. Bit of a brat, I suppose. But
he was a bit of a brat. But unfortunately, he was a dying brat when he wrote this.
Yeah, so the last squawk of a dying brat.
I don't think Mozart's Requiem has ever been introduced on Radio 3 in quite those terms before.
Thank you.
The Dies Irae, Tuba Mirum and Rex Tremendae from the Mozart Requiem, performed by the English Baroque Soloists and the Monteverdi Choir, conducted by Sir John Eliot Gardner. Quite distracting, I should have thought, even to somebody like you when you're writing that.
Well,
bit.
That particular extract, you can imagine. You know, I'd say the word per minute count rises somewhat.
Yes, gets you going. Yeah.
Productivity rises. Yeah, it should be played in every factory.
There's quite a contrast between the lyrical richness of the Pergolesi and the Mozart you've chosen and the more abstract, minimalist, contemporary music, like the next piece, the Michael Nyman, which reflects one of your other passions, football. I don't think it's exactly a chant from the terraces there.
No, luckily. they're best left on the terraces.
Yeah, this is After Extra Time by Michael Nyman. Why do you like it?
Well, I like Michael Nyman's work.
He's a football fan.
Yes, he supports QPR. Mm-hmm. And he has my
sympathy. Must be a very depressing
it
thing.
It must be.
I really liked them at one time.
Yeah, they were. They've had their moments. And I think the Premier Division is always better off with them. And hopefully they'll bounce back up. But I like his work, and I always felt with a film with the Michael Nyman soundtrack is always a better film. This, as far as I know, isn't from a film. It's just it's the meeting of his genius, which is music, and his enthusiasm, which is football. I think After Extra Time, it's great fun for a start, but there's something about it. You can see the football. Now, you need to have seen it before, played to a Martian, and he's not going to visualise football. But it's the two passions conjoined, and I think it's absolutely brilliant. And I remember when I heard it the first time, I told friends who love football about it as well, and we all ended up being huge, you know, Michael Nyman enthusiasts, to the extent that when Michael Nyman would be playing, the Michael Nyman band, as he calls it, you know, would be playing in Dublin, we'd all go. He's kind of rock and roll, Michael Nyman, you know. He seems to be what a middle-aged rocker should be like, in a way.
Well, that's a very interesting point, because I think one of the reasons that so-called, we have to use a label here, minimalist music, you know, Reich, Adams, Glass, Nyman, one of the reasons it's become very popular is that it is very close to pop music in many ways. I'm sure that is one of the reasons for its appeal, that it is accessible for that reason. It uses tonality.
Yeah. It's also composed by people who grew up with rock and roll. People who are like me, and there's many of us, you hear something and you want to hear a bit more of something. So you want to, you know, I suppose educate yourself sounds a bit grim. But that's what we're doing. We're educating ourselves. So we start with somebody and move on to somebody else and we see, oh, there's something else here. So you start off with music, perhaps, that obeys all the rules. And then you want to, oh, well, let's bend the rules and see what happens. And you end up with this music that has no rules whatsoever, as far as you know. And you mightn't be moved by it, but you're interested in it. And I think it's a common experience, I think, among people my age.
Thank you.
Judging by the end of that piece, I would imagine that's another game that QPR lost 3-0.
But there is, rather as with the Steve Reich, there's the feeling of kicking an idea around.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? A simple cell of notes.
Yes.
Which you look at from different angles.
Yes, I think so. And I think, again, I'm talking as an uneducated person, but I think that's one of the attractions of it as well. How many things you can do with so little.
Music from Michael Nyman's After Extra Time. Well, the next musician is a contemporary hero in many ways and has been a huge influence on all kinds of musicians, including U2, the Dublin band, and it's Brian Eno.
Yeah. I suppose the first time I saw or was aware of Brian Eno was on the old Grey Whistle Test when he was a member of Roxy Music. He was that strange creature in the corner with...
He did look sort of nerdish.
I wouldn't call him nerdish. I suppose in retrospect, everybody looked nerdish, but he was hiding behind Brian Ferry a bit, and it was brand new music to my ears. I've never heard anything like it before. Wasn't altogether convinced at first that I did like it. I was playing it recently, and it's incredible, that early Roxy music. It stood the test of time, really. So there he was, and then he's on Top of the Pops, and then he leaves. But then, you know, in the 70s, he keeps popping up, and he's producing music by Talking Heads, a band I love. He's doing all this music in Berlin, you know, with U2, and more importantly, perhaps with David Bowie. Then he's producing music of his own. It's an incredible body of work.
And this is an ending from the album, Apollo Atmosphere and Soundtracks.
Yes, and I chose it because it's sort of self-contained and it's relatively well-known as well. I think it was... I live in the Republic of Ireland, so, was, you know, I'd keep an eye on British politics, but I think it was used...
A wary eye.
An amused eye of late, really, in the last 5 or 6 years. There's a lot to laugh at. And, you know, there's no more laughter left in Irish politics, so we're looking elsewhere for our amusement. But it was used, in the Liberal Party political broadcast. And I could imagine, it's such a beautiful piece of music that I could imagine it. I don't want to talk about Brian Eno as a propagandist or whatever, but I could see myself changing my mind after hearing a piece of music like that.
Music from An Ending, from the 1983 album by Brian Eno, Apollo atmospheres and soundtracks. I gather quite a lot of people asked to have that music played at their funeral.
It wouldn't be one of mine. No, I'd prefer something a bit more cheerful, I think. There's a Bill Callahan song. He has a band called Smog, and the second track on one of his albums is called Dress Sexy at My Funeral. I think that'll be... And the first line, Dress Sexy at My Funeral, My Sweet Wife. And I think that might be one of mine.
Actually, talking of funerals, your latest book, The Guts, manages to avoid the funeral moment. But in this, we revisit Jimmy Rabbit of the Commitments, now a middle-aged father of four and suffering from bowel cancer. Other characters from the Commitments and its sequels reappear, and I was wondering whether you attempted to reunite the band.
I think the notion of bringing a group of middle-aged people together to find their very short-lived glory days would be a terrible mistake, a really awful mistake. But emotionally, I've brought the Commitments back together again, and professionally back together again, without having to go through the humiliation of writing some awful bloody sequel, you know?
Jimmy takes up the trumpet in The Guts, and that is something that you too have done, although I gather you have not brought it with you.
I haven't brought it with me because I was moving across here for 10 weeks, so it seemed like, one too many things to bring with me. But actually at this point I'm looking forward to getting back to it. It's part of my daily routine. I blast out a few bad notes every, a couple of times a day.
Wasn't your wife slightly responsible?
I was snoring badly and, I wasn't aware of this, but apparently it was keeping her awake. And at one point I stopped breathing, just to worry her, to see if she'd notice.
Well, she might have been very relieved after all the snoring.
And she, she Googled and read somewhere that playing a brass instrument could often be a help.
But you don't do that in the middle of the night in bed.
Play the trumpet.
No. At least not that one.
I hadn't thought about that, actually. That's another thing to do. But the man who sold me the trumpet, just after Christmas a few years back, said, you'll be playing tunes in a year, by next Christmas. And I was writing The Guts at the time, and I thought, well, wouldn't that be a lovely message for Jimmy's wife to give Jimmy, just as he's going into chemotherapy, to give him the trumpet for Christmas and to say, you'll be playing a tune, So I took the grim middle-aged fact of my life and plonked it into fiction, I didn't have or don't have bowel cancer. I was just snoring.
More mundane. How have the children taken to the playing of the trumpet?
With great amusement. The first time I hit a note, there was a burst of applause from downstairs and the dog was barking. So it's great amusement. The house, the kids play, is midway.
And has it helped the snoring?
Well, I'm asleep, so I don't know and I don't care.
No, but do you get reports?
I've had written reports, yes. I had had reports and independent research would appear to, to indicate that, the snoring isn't as bad as it used to be. Either that or my wife is a deeper sleeper than she used to be. Either way, it's worked out grand.
You've chosen, finally, something completely different from anything else we've had. A wonderful love song by a wonderful character.
Yeah, it's Leaning on a Lamppost, sung by George Formby. And I love the song. I just love it. And I it's one of his, I suppose it's not one of his funny songs as such. It's not one of his slightly rude songs. And it is, when you look at it and listen to it and the way he sings it, it is a working class man waiting for his lady, as he calls her, to hoping she'll turn up. And again, it's one of the great, isn't it, one of the great moments of teenage life and early 20s life, pre-smartphone, wondering if she'll turn up. And I always imagine her to be a maid of some sort. And whether she turns up or not, it perhaps isn't in her gift that she's hoping to be able to escape. So I find his voice really kind of vulnerable, hopeful, lovely humour in it. And he used the limits of his voice extremely well. And I just think it's a wonderful love song.
Of course, it has a banjo solo, so I wonder whether that reminds you of your father a little bit.
No, not really. But Formby played in the Palace Theatre, and when I read that, I just felt so happy because The Commitments is currently in the Palace Theatre, and I know that other musicals have been in the Palace Theatre, but when I read that George Formby was on the same stage as, The Commitments, I just felt very, very happy.
I think that's a lovely note on which to play out George Formby and to say, Roddy Doyle, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm leaning on a lamp. Maybe you think I look a tramp, or you may think I'm hanging round to steal a car. But no, I'm not a crook, and if you think that's what I look, I'll tell you why I'm here and what my motives are. I'm leaning on a lamppost at the corner of the street in case a certain little lady comes by. Oh me, oh my, I hope the little lady comes by. I don't know if she'll get away, she doesn't always get away, but anyhow I know that she'll try. Oh me, oh my, I hope the little lady comes by. There's no other girl I would wait for, but this one I'd break any date for. I won't have to ask what she's late for. She wouldn't leave me flat, she's not a girl like that. Oh, she's absolutely wonderful and marvellous and beautiful, and anyone can understand why. I'm leaning on a lamppost at the corner of the street in case a certain little lady passes by. I'm leaning on a lamppost at the corner of the street in case a certain little lady comes by. Oh me, oh my, I hope the little lady comes by. I don't know if she'll get away, she doesn't always get away, but anyhow I know that she'll try. Oh me, oh my, I hope the little lady goes. One da 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 dee bum bum. There's no other girl I could wait for, but this one I'd break any date for. I won't have to ask what she's late for. She wouldn't leave me flat, she's not a girl like that. Oh, she's absolutely wonderful and marvellous and beautiful, and anyone can understand why. I'm leaning on a lamppost at the corner of the street in case a certain little lady passes by.
Sure, I don't need to tell you that that was George Formby leaning on a lamppost and ending this week's edition of Private Passions. The details of all of Roddy Doyle's music choices are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website, and you can also download that programme and indeed others in the series from the same page. Private Passions was presented by Michael Barclay. It was produced by Jane Greenwood, and it's a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. Next week, Michael's guest is the critic Martin Gayford.
Verdi, Bruch and Beethoven in Radio 3 live in concert from Manchester's Bridgewater Hall. I'm Martin Handley. Join me for the Eroica Symphony, Bruch's first violin concerto, and celebrating Verdi's bicentenary year, the overture to his opera Nabucco. Friday night on BBC Radio 3 at 7:30.
Well, back to today. A very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly. I'm here with our programmes this afternoon here on Radio 3. I have a lunchtime recital for you in just a moment. The first of five visits, in fact, to the annual Schubertiad in Schwarzenberg in Austria this week. This afternoon, the music of Richard Strauss and Fauré sit alongside that of Schubert. Then we'll be off to the Brighton Early Music Festival to hear music that ranges from the 19th century back to the Renaissance. The event was billed as an informal evening of music at the festival, and you can hear the Little Baroque Company in action, as well as a sackbut quartet and flautist and guitarist and a viol consort playing some early string music, all in the early music show from 2 o'clock this afternoon. First, though, a summary of the news this lunchtime. Three police officers accused of giving a misleading account of a meeting with the former government chief whip, Andrew Mitchell, will now be investigated by the police watchdog. Two of the three are also being recalled to Parliament to clarify evidence they previously gave about the incident to MPs on the Home Affairs Select Committee. Ministers have shelved plans to force some visitors to the UK to pay a £3,000 deposit on entering, which would have been lost if they'd overstayed their visas. The Liberal Democrats and some countries targeted by the scheme had criticised the proposals. The employers' organisation, the CBI, has given a cautious welcome to a proposal from Labour to offer an incentive to firms to increase the salaries of staff on low incomes. Labour is promising companies a tax break if they pay employees the so-called living wage, which is about £2 more than the minimum wage. The party argues the plans would also bring down the welfare bill, as people on low incomes often have their salaries topped up with benefits. The lawyer of a Bangladeshi man living in London, who's been sentenced to death in his home country for crimes committed during its 1971 War for Independence, says he rejects the allegations entirely. Chaudhry Muin Uddin was found guilty of the abduction and killing of 18 people by a special war crimes tribunal in Dhaka. But his lawyer, Toby Cadman, said his prosecution was politically motivated. The American Secretary of State, John Kerry, who's on a visit to Cairo, has said the US is committed to working with Egypt's military-backed government. Mr. Kerry also played down Washington's partial suspension of military aid to Egypt after the ousting of the elected Islamist president, Mohamed Morsi, in July. A book by a GP from Edinburgh about his time spent at a research station at the South Pole has been awarded Scotland's largest literary prize. Gavin Francis won the Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust Book of the Year award for his work Empire Antarctica. The weather for this afternoon, there'll be a mixture of sunny spells and showers for most parts. Winds will gradually die down, but heavier rain will then arrive in southwestern parts later on. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's now 3 minutes past one. So now, the first of that series of lunchtime concerts this week on Radio 3, which were all recorded earlier this year during the annual Schubertiad, which takes place in Schwarzenberg, not far from the border with the Czech Republic. It's a festival dedicated to Schubert's music that's been going since 1976. It started small but quickly developed into a world-renowned event and attracts all manner of international names now, in around 70 events and with an audience of 30,000 visitors a year. Well, this concert was a big draw. The soprano Diana Damrau joined forces with the harpist Xavier de Maistre to perform music not just by Schubert but by Strauss, Fauré and Chausson. They began with Schubert, a set of songs which includes perhaps one of his most famous, Du bist die Ruhe. It's also a devil to sing. It suggests a transcendental religious experience. The words are by the poet Rückert, who was something of an expert on Eastern religions. You are peace, the mild peace. You are longing and what stills it. They begin the set, though, with one of Schubert's serenades, Ständchen number 4. My songs beckon softly through the night to you. Below, in a quiet grove, come to me, beloved.